if the industry as a whole does not invest in a vibrant, independent support infrastructure for these artists who are out in the van, who are building their fan bases organically, then that's going to impact them at the festival and stadium level.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Music Ally Focus. I'm Music Ally's editor, Joe Sparrow, and we welcome to the podcast this week, So Far Sound's CEO, Jim Lucchese, to talk about the current economics of live music and the impact of it on local and independent artists. All of that in just 1 minute. Now, if you're not familiar with the Music Ally Focus podcast, we take a look, a focused look, in fact, at one important topic in the music industry each time with expert guests. And of course, that means that the podcast is going to be fairly quick. In fact, it should take about the same amount of time as hypothetically Patrick Bertoletti could eat 160 bananas. Patrick peeled and ate 8 bananas in 1 minute in 2012. And I'm no expert on peeling and eating bananas at pace, but I feel like that's another record that could be broken. Feel free to email me if you do achieve it. Now, talking of biting off more than you can chew, live music is hard at the best of times, but for smaller and emerging artists, it can be financially brutal. And for venues as well, it can be incredibly difficult and increasingly difficult with the financial pressures of the world at the moment on their already slender margins. Many artists now get their start playing at So Far Sound shows, and the company is aiming, it says, to close the connection between the artist and fan even further. So I spoke to Jim about some of the key issues that he sees in that space, including what artists are saying to So Far Sounds about the pressures on them to perform and the money that they can or cannot make, what the main problems are on grassroots venues and grassroots performances right now, and what the solutions are, in his opinion, both at grassroots level, but also in terms of the responsibility of the bigger players in the live space for nurturing those artists much lower down the pyramid to help build future stars. Let's go over to Jim right now. Well, I'm very happy to welcome So Far Sound's CEO, Jim Lucchese, to the podcast. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Joe. How's it going?
Good, thank you. And thanks for joining us. Now, interesting topic to talk about here, which is the current sort of state of local independent live music and the economics of that. This is a topic which is affecting a lot of people around the world in a lot of different markets. So some really good things to talk about here. But before we get into the weeds with that one, can you just give us some basic introductions, please? Who you are, what you do, and the sort of nutshell of what So Far is, please.
Sure. My name's Jim Lucchese. I'm the CEO here at So Far. And So Far is an artist services company, and we're focused on bringing artists and audiences together through intimate live music events in about 400 cities around the world, and by providing artists with live and live-centric artist services to help them own their fan data, own their fan relationships, whether that's a artist playing their first gig in their local hometown or artist playing at the stadium level. I've been the CEO here for about 5 years.
Right. And for context, how long has So Far been around now?
Almost 15. So Far really started as a grassroots movement founded in London by Rafe Offer, who's the current, current chairman, founder, and friend. And two other folks, one of whom's a musician, who just started doing house shows in London because they were tired of going to club shows where people weren't listening, where the music was kind of incidental, and, you know, just started doing house shows. That organically grew from London to then Chicago to New York and word of mouth to hundreds of cities around the world.
And so, of course, like you say, there's this huge network of these shows now, and yes, I mean, it's anyone who's ever been to one, and I've been to a few over the years as well, and you're seeing artists who are perhaps taking first steps into that independent performing artist scene, but you're also seeing artists who are more experienced and they're doing something intimate as well. But you're really seeing a bunch of artists who are in this independent artist scene with a local audience and taking steps sort of in and around that growth phase. And like you say, with 15 years of experience, you've seen a lot of those people pass through your network. So from your perspective, or from So Far's perspective, what are the most painful pressures on local indie artists and venues and audiences right now?
Yeah, you know, it's a really critical time. And you're right, the majority of artists that play so far shows are either local artists or independent touring artists. 200 or so artists have gone on to Grammy nominations, but we believe deeply that local and independent music is the soul of every city. It's what makes, you know, Boston different than Berlin, than London, and everywhere else around the world. So we see true value in every one of those voices. Now, the reality is that in most of the West, the venues that used to be in downtown cities that were, you know, low cover, they had their own built-in draw where local and independent artists could be heard. Cities have just, the economics around cities have become more hostile to these types of venues, and many of them have closed. And really, so far, over the last 15 years, has been a grassroots, community-driven approach to creating spaces where these artists can be heard. The desire for local artists to play to an attentive audience and local audiences wanting to discover music live, we didn't invent that. That's timeless and universal anywhere in the world. But certainly the economic pressures on venues to be sustained has gotten a lot tougher. Here in Boston, where I am, my 3-block walk to work, I passed 3 places that I used to play, collectively played probably, you know, those places 100 times, that are now closed. 2 are condos and 1 will become condos soon. Fortunately, in the UK, the UK Venues Trust actually tracks this and tracks how small and grassroots venues are doing. And they cited that 2023 was the worst year in the history, the toughest year for those venues in the history of them tracking. So that challenge creates a ripple effect that impacts the cultural character of cities, and certainly the ability for local independent artists to be heard.
Of course, the pressures, those economic pressures, which are, you know, they sound so banal when you put them like this. You know, it's about paying rent and paying electricity bills and all those things, which put extreme pressure on a very low margin business like that. What sort of feedback are you getting then from artists and audiences in terms of their needs being met? Because if local performances are so important to the community, which I think everyone agrees that they are, this infrastructure is failing to support that. So what are the sort of knock-on effects of that?
Well, I guess to back up a little bit and talk about what attracted me to So Far and which is largely what attracts artists to play So Far. When I first came across So Far, it was through several musician friends of mine who were playing in Boston, then Philly, then Baltimore, D.C., largely Northeast U.S. And what struck me in coming to see them play and what they shared with me was, first of all, there's a listening room. So this is an audience of people who are coming to see 3 artists unannounced. And so they don't even know who they're going to see, and they're going to see a diverse lineup. So it self-selects to people who are there to discover new music. And the focus is these artists, so they are heard. And so what attracted me, and what, when we do surveys and ask artists why they perform, number one, the fact that an artist can show up and they don't have any pressure to fill the room is really important at a time where in many places that pressure to draw is quite intense. These are shows where we fill the room, or So Far fills the room, and the artist can just show up and play. Secondly, is that people are there for you. They're not there for the bar. They're not there for, you're not background. You are in the foreground. And that gives artists the ability to really tell their story. And the result of that is a level of connection between artist and audience. You're sitting 5 feet away from somebody, and among the audience themselves, that's quite unique. So those are the elements that attracted me, and those are certainly the elements that, you know, I think many of the elements of why artists play So Far shows. And if you look at the kind of stress points that artists that we work with are feeling today, touring is much tougher. There are fewer places to play, even post-pandemic. We're still feeling that. Tour routing is more challenging. The expense of touring is greater. Longer gaps between shows. So in our case, we have about 3,000 artists last year who played So Far tours because we're in so many cities. And then that constant fight for attention at a time where I think we are, particularly on social media, attention decay is creating exhaustion among artists who just feel like they want to be musicians. And there's a real pressure to an exhaustion around feeling like you need to be a content creator and constantly fight for attention. So to be able to sit and be your authentic self as a musician is another thing that we hear quite a bit. And then something that surprised me over the years here that I wouldn't have expected when I joined, but it's certainly I hear quite a bit now, and that is the connection among artists. Being an independent artist can feel quite solitary, especially when you're out on the road. And connecting with other artists, you know, at our shows, and then what goes in the collaborations that come from that, and just being with musicians who are doing the same thing that you're doing, is another element that, you know, I think that artists have a hunger for today. And I would say that, lastly, that that's not just for independent artists. We've heard from each of the majors who have developing artists on their roster, who really are focused on building an audience live, and doing so in a way where there's a true listening room.
One of the sort of the points you made there is about the desire of the audience that goes to these shows to go and enjoy local or touring live music. And they go because they love live music and they want to go and see it, right? What is the state of that today? Because this is something which has changed dramatically. We've had an explosion of live music over the last however many years, let's say 20 years. And we've also seen ticket pricing going up in hand with that. And then in recent years, we've also seen the change of how music is consumed in an online sense, in a recorded sense, completely changed as well. And discovery has changed, and relationships with artists have changed because, of, like you say, some artists are content creators and musicians, and it's all become very, very different very quickly. So what is that live music audience like now? And what's the effect of that? Because there's one argument which says, well, people are very prepared to go and pay $150 on a Taylor Swift ticket or more, frankly.
Those are the fees.
Yes. That's so you can print it out at home. But okay, they're willing to spend, let's say, $200 on a ticket to see Taylor Swift or to see a Madonna or a big headline ticket act, but they're not willing to spend, you know, 10 times a $20 ticket to see an act that they're not 100% sure about or perhaps don't know very well. Is that a dynamic you recognize?
I would push back on part of that. I would acknowledge that the exceptionally high prices, particularly in the States, on the festival side and at the stadium level, do absolutely have an impact on people's overall budgets for live music. And our audience surveys definitely support that. And if you speak to agents or artists at the kind of club level, they feel that in the summertime as well. But that is not to say that I do not believe in from you know, our growth, that audiences desire to slow down and actually fall in love with an artist versus a song on a playlist has changed at all. If anything, I think that interest in that level of connection is greater now than it's been since I've been working in music. You mentioned, you know, streaming services in social media, and you know, have a fair amount of experience in the area of streaming and music discovery. In the breadth of music discovery possible today through recommendations and playlists is, you know, largely quite positive in that you don't need to be on a major label anymore. You don't need terrestrial radio promotion to find an audience and to connect with that audience. And the breadth of that, those discovery opportunities, is unprecedented. But the depth of that connection, the depth of a song on a playlist that's going to refresh weekly versus the depth of connection when you're sitting 5 feet away from an artist and she's telling you the story behind the songs, you fall in love with the artist, not a song. And that fan connection is deeper. It has a sense of personal ownership and advocacy. And that's how, that level of fan connection is critical to artists building sustainable fan bases. Whether that's 1,000 fans or 100,000 fans or more, that depth of connection is quite critical. And from where we sit, audiences and artists both crave that depth of connection now more than ever.
You also mentioned, and I just want to touch on this a bit more, about the smaller venues closing their doors because of the pressures on them. Does that suggest then that there's going to be a sort of permanent shift to a different model where, you know, you're saying, you know, there's audiences who still want to experience live music at the lower end of the ticket pricing spectrum, of the emerging artist spectrum, and that seems to be true. People do want that. The infrastructure previously was small venues and locally located in the center of cities and towns that supported that. They are unfortunately closing at a rate. Do you think that suggests that there is a shift in the infrastructure and model of that? Because So Far Sounds obviously offers a sort of alternative to that. And I know you believe in that model, but I mean, is there a sort of, what's the balance going to look like in the future?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, it's in particularly after the pandemic, it's a really important question in that, you know, I think we're in the greatest disruption in use of urban space, certainly in my lifetime. The 7-year, you know, fixed leases in urban centers are being completely rethought, and how a space is used is changing quite a bit. At the same time, the demand for artists and audiences to connect locally hasn't changed at all. In fact, there's, you know, more music being created and distributed today now than ever. Yeah. Those artists need a place to be heard, and there are audiences who want to hear them. So yes, So Far is one grassroots, you know, community-driven approach to create these spaces. But I certainly think there are going to be more. I'm heading to Austin to South by Southwest next week, and you know, I've been going for 15 plus years now, and there's a band tucked into every corner of that city.
Yeah,
3,000 bands, right? And yeah, it's just it is a magical situation when there's that much live music in a city. And my hope is that, you know, in the future with this disruption, I So Far will be a part of this, but I expect many others will as well. Again, the demand is there. It creates a more rich, culturally rich environment for the city. So I think it's just about finding ways to create more spaces for that music to take place live.
Do you have any ideas what that might be like? Because, I mean, I know that's a difficult question, but like, space, use of space is changing. It's going to change again. We're looking at, you know, use of business spaces versus living spaces in the cities is in a real fluctuation. We're seeing rent prices go up, whether you're a home renter or a business renter, by in the double figures in the last year. I mean, this is a very tumultuous time. Like you say, there's going to be a need to see live music in every local area, but you know, what might those spaces be if they're not small venues that are dedicated to that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, last year alone, we probably hosted shows in over 5,000 different non-traditional spaces. Those could be, you know, breweries or restaurants or hotel roof decks or, you know, any form of local business, from a bike shop to a piano factory. And you know, I think those local businesses want to be more closely connected to their local community. Mm. Our target are the demographics of the folks who come to our shows are typically 25 to 35 year olds living in those cities. And who they support is really important to them as well. So there's an associative aspect of that for the folks who host our shows as well. So, you know, I think as people are rethinking how space is used, the fact that you can convert a space into a special music experience from, you know, 6 to 10 p.m. Creates a lot of opportunity for those places to create those spaces where music can be heard. I still don't think anybody does it as well as Austin does it for that 1 week, but, you know, I think
yes.
I think lots of cities are looking at it the same way. We work with a lot of one interesting thing that's come to us is cities who are promoting tourism in their city by sending their local artists to other cities to showcase. We've done that with a group of London artists who played across the East Coast of the U.S. We've done it with Toronto, where we're kicking off a campaign with Washington, D.C., who is taking, you know, some local artists in Washington, D.C., and then sending them to other cities. And you know, showcasing local music as the identity of a city is something that these opportunities kind of came to us. I think it's another recognition that cities have that, you know, local artists matter.
There's a pyramid, isn't there, here, of lots of small artists at the bottom and Taylor Swift on the top, right? And so you've got big promoters, big venues, big booking agents working with those bigger artists towards the top of the pyramid. But of course, new artists need to enter that to enable the next generation of those superstar artists to fill their places or to join them alongside them as the pie grows. Do those big players, whether they're venues, promoters, whoever, do they have a responsibility to financially support these spaces for emerging artists at the bottom of the pyramid?
Well, I'm not sure I would say that any business has a responsibility per se. We certainly at SoFar feel, our mission is to create those spaces. I would say that if the industry as a whole does not invest in a vibrant, independent support infrastructure for these artists who are out in the van, who are building their fan bases organically, then that's going to impact them at the festival and stadium level. So artist development is absolutely critical. I think we're asking more of artists today than it's hard to say than ever before, because so many things have changed. Artists are empowered with so many more ways to directly build their own fan bases today than ever before. But it's not a controversial point to say that investment in artist development and giving artists the space and the support to develop their creative voice is critical to those stadium acts of tomorrow, without question. You know, Billie Eilish, Yeba, many of those artists played SoFar shows early on alongside, many other ways that they were supported. And that investment is really important. It doesn't mean that if you're running a large festival that you have that responsibility, but certainly if we don't create ways for it to be sustainable for artists to make a living focusing on their art, we're all going to feel it. We're going to feel it in that hometown, and yeah, we'll feel it at the festival level as well.
And when it comes to the people who are involved with at that grassroots level, okay, you've got artists, you've got venue staff, you've got everyone involved, and then being paid. As we said at the start, it's a very low margin business. It's really hard. Now, like a long time ago, SoFar was part of a controversy, and settlements were made around monetary compensation for artists and workers. What have you learned from that and through everything else over 15 years as a company that can give us a bit of insight into the future landscape of all the people involved with making live music and performing live music and how they get paid from it?
Sure. Yeah. I think to clarify or to respond to your point around the past, SoFar, as I mentioned, started as a grassroots pass the hat community, right? It was much more of a movement for the first decade or so than a business. As it evolved from that to starting to sell tickets, that's when, this issue came up in one state, that was New York, and that was, close to 5 years ago. I want to be 100% clear. Anywhere that SoFar operates, if we're making money, the artists are making money, and everybody working the show is getting paid. That's been the case largely since I've been here. I've been here close to 5 years, or over 5 years now. And, our mission and what attracted me to SoFar, and I believe that our artists are our customers, is the fact that live represents 85% of revenue for the majority of the artists that we serve, and we need to treat them as customers. So that's been the case from the onset. And, you touched on something else as well that I think is important to the vibrancy of cities. And that's the people who work at these shows, right? These are people who are, many of them are musicians. Others just really want to be connected to supporting local artists. And having ways to do that in the local economy are also really, really important. I think we employ about 650 crew members across the U.S. and the U.K. who are working part-time at our shows. And as far as the future that goes, I think there are so many ways, and I think there are lots of innovators out there who are thinking about new ways to empower artists and how they build that audience and how they create different types of live music experiences. For us, the show that we've done 40,000 times is unannounced artists, each play about a 25-minute set, diverse lineup, all focused on music discovery. And if you would play an opener in that city, it's a great gig for you. You get paid better than an opener. You're not expected to draw one person to that show. And you could literally play so far as Wednesday, Thursday, Friday night, and then sell hard tickets to your Saturday headliner show. And because we fill the room, we're not taking any, that's not competitive to us. We're not taking anything out of the market. As we continue to grow, a big focus of ours is creating shows or show formats where artists can make headliner money. Since the pandemic, we've done a little over 1,000 shows where the average pay was, in the $1,200 range. So we want to make sure that, yes, when you're just starting out or if you're on the road building your audience in a new city, so far discovery shows are a great way to do that. But as you get to that point where you're a bit more established commercially, we don't want you to, quote, graduate from so far. We want to be able to continue working with you and give you tools to build your fan base. Part of that drove our acquisition of Seeded 3 years ago. And Seeded is a technology-enabled artist services company that gives artists the tech and tools to actually own their fan data. So when you promote your shows, when you promote merch, directly capturing email addresses and SMS from your fan base such that you can grow, we can work with an artist manager from their artist that they just signed to their most established artists. Or we can work with an artist from the time they play their first show to when they are out doing festivals and, playing to 10,000 plus people.
But what are the other ambitions and growth points that you're looking to achieve in the next 5 years or so?
Diversifying the types of show experiences that artists can play with so far, such that we can work with an artist for their first show. We can help those artists when they're out on the road developing markets and as they continue to grow. And then largely through the Seeded suite of services, helping those artists not just capture their fan data and own it directly, but then how to make the most of that. How to make the most of that through pre-sale access to tickets, through other types of VIP experiences. I'm a big believer that artists who are playing much larger rooms also really want, and their fans really want, more intimate and genuine ways, their top fans, to connect. And so far, it's uniquely situated to be able to do that, in that we have folks on the ground in virtually every city in the world. So we launched VIP about 18 months ago. We have done close to 1,500 VIP experiences with about 100-150 artists. And that's another really important part of our growth strategy over the next several years is to work with those artists to help them create these more unique experiences for their top fans.
Okay. Well, I'll put some links to so far on the various projects you've mentioned beneath the podcast, and people can check those out themselves. One final question before I let you go, Jim, which you've got to, if you restricted this question just to the artists who played last year, you'd have a difficult time picking, I'm sure. But this is a personal question. So what is your, if you could only pick one piece of music to listen to for the rest of your life, what would that be?
Come on.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Yes.
Oh, I don't know.
It could be an album. So it could be like a cluster of music, if you like.
Okay. Let's see. I mean, I couldn't live without John Coltrane's Love Supreme. If I had to pick one, if I really had to pick one, that would be the one that I picked.
Right.
Because I think your relationship with that album just grows over time and I think always will. So that would be my one pick.
That's a good choice because obviously it's a great album, right? But it's strategic because, as you say, there's so much in that album. It's going to grow with you as you'll never get bored of hearing it.
No, it's more than hearing it, right? It's an album that reflects a spiritual truth that everyone who's playing on that record was deeply connected to. And I think that's part of the reason why it'll grow with any listener forever. I'm not saying it's the only one. I hate ranking things. But sure. If I were really, really forced at gunpoint to grab one record and head someplace, that would probably be the one.
Okay. I can only commend that choice. So I will link to that below the podcast as well. And that's it. So, Jim Lucchese, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Thanks again to Jim. If you found that podcast useful, please share the episode on with someone else who you think will get something out of it. If you'd like to get in touch with me, of course, I'd like to hear from you. Please email me. It's joejoe@musically.com. Don't forget, you can keep in touch another way. We have a free weekly email that comes out every Friday and lands with a wet thump in your inbox called The Knowledge, which rounds up bits and pieces of the best analysis, news, marketing insight, and skills from across Music Ally's broad range of services. So sign up and you will immediately become a better person. Links to all of that are in the description, as always. And thank you, as always, for listening. I've been Joe Sparrow. You have been you. And until next time, farewell.